Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's September 11th, 2020, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC. And we've got football. We're one game into the season with the defending champion, Kansas City Chiefs, kind of running all over the Houston Texans. We'll talk about that game for a little bit later on today. Mainly, we'll go over just a couple of the new contracts that came in the NFL. A couple different notes on restructures and just some things that I think are out there right now that people are kind of getting wrong when it comes to going over that stuff. So we'll get into that. We'll start off with a beer of the week. Yeah, we got a beer of the week again. We're off our low carb kind of stuff. So, you know, just in time for football season, right? So today we've gone with the pumpkin ale from Whole Hog. This is the first time I've tried this. This is pretty good. I got to say, if I had to compare this to other pumpkins, if you were interested in this type of drink at all, I'd say that this is probably pretty close to what I consider the top two, which are the pumpkin ale from Dogfish Head and the pumpkin from Southern Tier. I think this might be just below those two. I haven't had them in a while, so I can't say that for certain, but I would say that this definitely ranks up there with the best seasonals that I've had. You know, some other ones that I've liked from this group, Shipyard makes one. Pumpkinhead maybe is the name of theirs. That's pretty good as well. Smutty Nose makes a decent one too. I think that's just a pumpkin ale, I think is what they call that one. But this is pretty good. So this is definitely my top three. So if this is kind of what you're in the mood for, I would go for it. Obviously, I got to choose now since we've got football this weekend. I got to come up with something to drink during the Jets game. Maybe you guys can give me some advice on that one. But what's the best way to go to deal with the Jets in week one? Do we go with a double IPA? Do we go with just a, you know, straight up IPA? Do I go stick with the pumpkin beers and go seasonal for the fall? Or do we go something really dramatic and we look for some kind of triple IPA or something like that just to try to make the Jets seem reasonable during the game? Now, hopefully it won't be that bad. So a couple of the new contracts came down this week, and I think the place to start off was the Jalen Ramsey deal. The Jalen Ramsey contract to me is really a big game changer. They were able to move the market to $20 million a year. Just a fantastic offseason for their agents. he's negotiated just a number of tremendous deals for his clients this offseason. But this one is a legitimate contract that I think is going to push the market moving forward, because while there are a lot of positives with Jalen Ramsey, I don't know a lot of people that will say Jalen Ramsey is the best cornerback in the NFL. Well, they say that there are physical characteristics that he has that could make him the best cornerback in the NFL. Yeah, I think that that's possible. I don't think Jalen Ramsey is the best cornerback in the NFL. I'm not sure if he ever has been. So this is a terrific deal. Now, there are some comparisons, and we'll make those to the Tre'Davious White contract as well. We can look a little bit there, but they probably were not negotiating with that deal in mind. So really where they're working from is the baseline, which is going to be the Byron Jones contract, and to a lesser extent, probably the Darius Slay one. Those contracts were in the $16 million range on an annual basis is where those deals were. So, you know, we look through this here, and just to benchmark those deals, if you look at the first year, Ramsey will earn $30 million by the end of the first year. That's compared to $26 million and $16 million on the Slay deal. So let's just throw the Slay deal out just completely, because that's a shorter-term deal. That's one of those deals where the average value of the contract, even though technically it made him the highest paid in the NFL at $16.8 million, in terms of cash flows, because it's a shorter term deal and everything else, it's actually way behind the Byron Jones deal. So I think Jones is our real comparison here. We've got $45 million earned through in year two, compared to just $40 million for Byron Jones. We've got 62 through year three to 54.5. Then we've got 80.5 to 68.5. So that's really where it makes the turn. The Jalen Ramsey contract, and this is a big deal. It's big the whole way through. But they were really able to push that number when you get into the fourth year of the contract and the fifth year of the deal as well, where he's going to out-earn him $100 million to 82.5. Now, I'm sure one of the big things the Rams got out of this is the fact that they were able to get a fifth year, that they didn't have to hold this on a four-year deal or anything like that. So they do get a fifth year of control. But, you know, they paid a lot for that. And I think that's paying too much at a position that's so volatile. And the odds are, I don't know if he would really even get to the end of the deal. In terms of salary cap charges on this, let's take a look to see how that breaks down here. Let me just pull up his numbers. I still don't have the full details, I think, on the guarantee structure on this one. I think I was just kind of guessing at the guarantees based on the reports that were 71.2 at signing. So it's probably a reasonable guess that I have there. But basically, if you look at the dead money that's in this deal, and you look at the way the guarantees work out, he's going to be a Ram through 2023, unless they trade him. You know, there's a possibility, I guess, that you could trade him somewhere in there. But he's going to be a Ram through 2023. So that covers the first three new years of the deal. So if you want to go back and you want to look at the numbers, where you see a 62 compared to a 54.4, that's probably the reason that the Rams did this deal. That's 20.6 million. I got the wrong number up there. Yeah. They're at 62. I was giving you the numbers on the Tre'Davious White deal there. So they're at 20.67 through 3 years, and the market was at 18.12. So they jumped up a little bit, but I'm sure they look at this and they say, okay, you know, a $2.5 million jump per year, they probably consider that reasonable, from their perspective. And then if you get to those next set of years, you know, on the back end, I'm assuming that the theory is, okay, well, we're going to be happy at $20 million a year still, if he's still playing well enough to see this portion of the contract. So I think that's where that logic is coming from. Now, the other thing that this brings up that I've kind of brought up a little bit here, and I know a lot of people disagree with this assessment, and it's fair to disagree on this point completely. But one of the things that I do typically harp on with contracts, obviously, is new money. This is one of the things that usually drives me crazy. You'll see, usually it's Mike Florio will tweet stuff about contracts, and usually it drives me insane. So I'll tweet something out about it as a reply or whatever, because it's sometimes disingenuous to look at these deals not from a new money perspective. However, when you get into the trade market, I think things sometimes are a little bit different. And you know, when you look at these deals, when you look at them from a team perspective, they're looking at this completely differently at this point. You know, they wanted Jalen Ramsey. And obviously they had leverage over Jalen Ramsey in terms of doing the franchise tags and everything else. Forget their cap position, which wasn't good with the Rams. They did have some leverage, and you get that leverage when you trade in on a contract. But when you trade in on a contract, the last thing that you want to do is trade in on a guy and get into all kinds of issues when it comes to negotiating the deal. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit with Jamal Adams and the way that the Seahawks would value him. And I think when you get into the Jalen Ramsey deal, and one of the reasons why they're able to get to $20 million without maybe too much trouble here, is I think they look at this and they say, you know, we don't have any sunk cost in this player from a financial standpoint. Obviously, they've traded away draft picks here. But they're going to look at this as, you know, basically that they just signed a player for $100 million. Plus, they had him for this year for 13.7. Plus, they had him the year before. I know it was just a half year. You know what? Let's just throw that year out. So we'll call it a 113.7 over six. You know, and that brings the number down to 19 per year, which is a little bit more in line with the market. If you consider that other year as a part of it, you know, if you want to consider that as a full year, you know, we'll put the 3.6, even though they paid a little bit less than that. That gives you 7 years of control, and now you're at 16.8. And I think this is one of the ways where things can look at it differently. From Ramsey's perspective, he's clearly going to be negotiating on new money standpoint. And the Rams are going to argue in terms of new money, but you're going to use that to your advantage. In some cases, it's basically saying, look, we got to get a deal done. In our mind, we're perfectly happy with eventually getting to $20 million a year, because if we look at this as a 7-year deal, as a 6-year deal, for us, this is reasonable. It's not like we paid him and he's holding out. It's not like we did this, that, or the other thing that we really want to hold the feet to the fire on the contract. In a sense, we're kind of ripping up this deal and we're kind of doing something new. And if we look back at some of these trades that have gone on, this is where we're starting to see the biggest market movement. Now, some of it, granted, you can say that this is kind of stupidity by not getting these deals done early, because the traditional way to do this is you find a player who's unhappy with their contract, you know, kind of like the Vikings did with Ngakoue in Jacksonville. And you kind of exploit the fact that the player is unhappy with the contract and in turn, probably unhappy with the team he's playing for. And so before you do the trade, you kind of come to an agreement with the team, and then you will go back and you'll say, okay, this is going to be contingent on us getting an extension done. Like we need to talk to the player, we need to talk to his rep, and we want to get an extension done before we make this trade. But right now, teams aren't doing that. They're making these trades for these players, and I don't think that the bottom line is as important to them right now as to getting their hands on players who typically are not going to be out there in free agency. Though I would argue Jalen Ramsey would have been in there in free agency. But regardless, you know, Tunsil in Houston, just an obscene contract. DeAndre Hopkins just now in Arizona, pretty much an obscene contract. So what we're seeing is the when you extend a player, because there's a vested interest that you've had financially in that player, you know, you drafted him, you paid a bonus for him, all these other things, you kind of get, I think, deep in the weeds a little bit more when you get into some of these player valuations and you come up with different ways to value a contract and everything else. And you're still getting better deals than the unrestricted free agents for the most part, but you're not blowing the market away. On these trades, you're blowing the market away. Now, again, the part of this is the problem of the team trading for him, not getting the deal done ahead of time. But once they've made that decision that they don't care about getting that deal done ahead of time, I think that these teams are looking at this completely different than the way that we think sometimes. And I think that's clearly the case with this one. I think if you ask the Rams, in any way, shape, or form, they would not give you the same new money numbers that I just did. They would factor in the fact that there's 13.7 already in this deal. And to them, that's part of their negotiation because they didn't contract any of that in the first place. And I think this is one of those things that we're starting to see. And it's kind of interesting to see it take place, because I think if this is the way things are going, more and more players who are true star players should be pushing for trades, should be pushing to get out of their current situation, get to a team that they can leverage even more. Because again, from the player's perspective, all they care about is the new money. That's all they need to care about, the new money portion of the contract, not this, you know, 6 year, 7 year, whatever, but it gives you leverage to maximize your new money, you know, while at the same time, you know, getting out of a situation maybe that you didn't like. So I think it's something that really needs to be watched a little bit more, because these teams that are doing these trades are not paying any attention whatsoever to the new aspect of it. And then the question becomes, well, how much does it change the market? My feeling is this one absolutely will. And I'll talk about the White contract in a minute. But to go off that, the other one is DeAndre Hopkins. Now, Hopkins, I don't have the full numbers. I was reading Joel Corey had has the numbers. So he had them out there. And it's legitimate. I mean, there's raises over the existing deal and everything else. I don't look at that one necessarily as a market mover, though. I look at that more as an outlier deal. Arizona clearly looked at this as a five-year contract. They did not look at this as a two-year extension with a voidable year. They were just looking to have a happy camper on the field for them right now. You know, they basically guaranteed the existing portion of the contract, and if he makes it beyond that, he's going to make an absolute killing. Terrible job by Arizona, but I kind of understand what they're doing there. But again, I think that this is a deal that league-wide is going to get thrown out. You know, it's the same feeling I had with Julio Jones. Look, Julio Jones, great player. Everyone knows Julio Jones, great player. That extension that hit 22, nobody had come close to it. You know, nobody really did. And it's not because Julio Jones is 100 times better than Michael Thomas or Amari Cooper or whomever. Well, he's better than Amari Cooper. But, you know, it's not that he's that much better than the rest of the field. It's just that people looked at that and they said, you know what, there were two existing years. There was all kind of cap concerns. This is making good on a player who's been there forever. And you run into all these different scenarios. And I kind of think this is the same thing that's going to happen with that Hopkins deal. I think people are going to look at this as kind of an outlier contract. Now, I could be wrong on that, but I kind of think that in terms of the wide receiver deals that were recently signed, I think the Keenan Allen deal, which averages around 20, I think on that, I think the Keenan Allen deal is actually a bigger deal in terms of being a market mover, because Keenan Allen, who's a terrific player, you know, for him to get up to $20 million is pretty crazy, especially with the Chargers of all teams. Now, his deal is one of those, again, where it's not completely backloaded by any stretch, but there's a little bit of it there, I would say, that works in that direction. But, you know, the Hopkins deal, it is what it is for Arizona. I get, again, why they did it. But I don't think that one's going to have the impact that the Ramsey deal does. I just feel like that Ramsey deal is really going to do something, you know, for the position. For a position that's really been pretty stagnant, I think that's going to do something. And then that brings you to Tre'Davious White, who signed an extension that I think was clearly offered to him when he said he was going to opt out. If you remember a couple weeks ago, Tre'Davious White announced on Twitter that he was opting out. I think he had a sick family member. A lot of people got a little bit nasty with him, I think, on Twitter. But, you know, that's expected. I believe then it was just like, okay, everyone expected him to be on the list, and he never was. And he just vanished from there. And the first thought that I had on it is, all right, you know what? They're probably in extension talks, because him opting out really kind of could screw up your free agency. So I kind of think that is what maybe pushed that into the forefront there. Now, he's getting killed probably a little too much for not waiting for the Ramsey deal to come in. You know, good on the Bills. You know, that's another reason probably why the Bills entered into those talks. They probably wanted to get a deal done before the Ramsey deal got done, because I think they knew that the you know, Rams were pretty much held over a barrel with Ramsey, and that could really push the market. So they were willing to do a deal that kind of worked within the you know, the current framework of stuff. And White's getting killed for that, because his contract comes in, and he's a better player, I think, than Ramsey. But White's coming in at 17.25, which is, you know, a much more modest jump from the Byron Jones number. But if you look at this is what made this deal happen, and this is ways you can do it. And this is something that's kind of a little bit of a head scratcher with the Bills right now for me. Remember, we talked about Deion Dawkins a couple weeks ago, and I can tell you there's other people that were shocked by that as well. They basically gave him the Tunsil contract up front, And in return, you kind of get some lesser money on the back end to bring the numbers down. And that's the same thing they did with White. So White, through the first year of his deal, is going to earn about $36 million. So if you compare that to Jones, you know, Jones was at 26, and even Ramsey is only going to be at 30. So he's actually going to out-earn both of them through the first year of the contract. And remember, that they're not working off that Ramsey deal. They were working off the other deal. You get to the second year of the deal, he's going to earn 46. That's more than Ramsey's going to earn through those first 2 years of the deal. The third year is where we make that, you know, a little bit more of that that turn. You know, but again, it's not necessarily that far out. You know, Ramsey is at 62. White's going to be at 56.5 and Jones is at 54.4. And then it's that year four, which is really where he gets hammered, which is the 80.5 for Ramsey versus the 69 for White. But, you know, again, and this is where we lose focus sometimes on these things, where we just get concerned with the annual per year, average annual value of the deal. White is going to be a free agent come year five. So Ramsey is locked into a contract that'll get him to that 100. Byron Jones is locked into a contract that gets him to 82. And so the question is, well, if White continues to perform, where will the market be and what would he be able to earn? So let's say in this case that White earns, 25. Yeah, well, that's starting to bring him pretty close then. So, you know, there's different ways that you can look at it, but I think he's being a little bit too unfairly criticized. Now, could they have pushed it more? Yeah. And should they have waited? Yeah, I think they should have. I think the money up front was probably too good on this. White's contract has a pretty high guarantee. Let me see the number. Remember, there's 2 years of existing numbers in his existing contract guarantees that are, you know, you're kind of double counting in a sense on them. I have to look at it. They have a lot of vesting guarantees in the deal. So basically he's got 36.7 guaranteed up front. You know, that's light, that number, because he was already guaranteed basically 12. So that's a little bit light there. He's got 60 million injury protection. I would actually say that's not bad. Even if you back out the other stuff, you know, it's not terrible, but it's still a little bit light. It's less than Jones got. It's less than Ramsey got in terms of new money that's guaranteed. So they should have pushed for more injury protection. I think they should have been able to get probably another $10 million in injury protection. I think they probably could have gotten a little bit more money up front in terms of a full guarantee, probably another $10 million. Now, they do have probably early vesting on this. Let's take a look. Yeah, so he'll get a lot of early vesting. He's going to get $17 million in bonuses over the first 2 years. That's not as strong as Ramsey's deal, but the Rams are really in a pinch with their salary cap. I think this is actually not a bad deal for both sides. I think the Bills have, you know, really are spending a lot early in these deals. And when you do that, you know, you're really anticipating that the players are really going to outperform the contracts, because you need them to get to those back end years to make it worth your while, to do these contracts. So I'd say that there's definitely movement though at the quarterback position, overall. Other deals that came in, there was the Hayward deal. That's okay. You know, the Steelers are where they're going to be here. Clowney came in at 13. I think we'd already talked about that and already knew that deal. I think that's pretty much all the new ones that we had gotten some details on here. Now, the next thing that came up is we've seen a lot of contract restructures this week. And I kind of thought that there would actually be more, and I'm surprised that there haven't been. But it kind of was driving me a little bit crazy. So the Eagles gave a raise to Jason Peters the other day, and Lane Johnson at the same time basically restructured his deal to create however much in cap room. And immediately it was being reported that Lane Johnson restructured, so the Eagles had the space to extend or to increase the salary for Peters. Eagles have no salary cap concerns this year. The Eagles have salary cap concerns in 2021. They don't have salary cap concerns in 2020. They have one of the highest amounts of cap space in the NFL. They could have easily given Peters a raise and not had to touch anyone. What the Eagles needed to do, though, is they're trying to maximize their carryover for next year. So basically, you go in there and you restructure a player this year, and you can restructure him again next year. So it gives you two chances to create cap room. You know, when you restructure a player once, it's almost like, you know, what's the point? You know, in many cases, you know, if you don't need the money, you kind of say, well, why are you going to do it? You know, because all you're doing is adding to the cap number the following year. You're adding the cost of releasing the player, all that kind of stuff. But this year is unique because you can create money in two ways. You can create money by doing a contract now and maximizing your carryover. And then you can go back in if you need to again next year and restructure that same deal. It's always better to restructure early. If you're going to restructure earlier in a deal rather than later in a deal where you really start to put a lot of dead money towards the back end of the contract where you kind of might be turning away from them. So anyway, the same thing happened today with DeMarcus Lawrence. Thing gets announced that he signed a one-year voidable extension. Come on, people. It's a deal that's basically going to end up being an auto void. At least I'm pretty certain that's what it will be. Most contracts have built-in language to let you restructure automatically. But when you're adding years to a contract, you actually have to go and do it. So that they got to technically sign a new deal that adds a new year onto it. And whatever kind of condition to void, usually it's just a roster condition. What they did is they created $12 million in cap space by, you know, converting how much? $15 million, I think, to a bonus. And you say, wow, you know, Dallas did that. And immediately what starts coming out? Well, they must be signing Earl Thomas. You know, Dallas had space to sign Earl Thomas. They didn't need cap room to sign Earl Thomas. You know, especially the way his offsets work, I don't even know if they want to pay too much money for him. Next thing comes, well, they're going to do something with Prescott. They can't extend Prescott right now. The only thing they can do is if they were going to cut him, they could cut him and then extend him. But I don't see that one happening, especially with the salary guarantees, and there's no guarantee someone comes back and all those different things. So what are they doing it for? And it's the same reason we talked about with Philadelphia. What Dallas is doing is they're maximizing their carryover for next year. Dallas created about $27 million or so in cap room by three restructures. They did Tyron Smith a couple weeks ago. They did Zach Martin last week. And then they did DeMarcus Lawrence yesterday. Three deals, $27 million. They don't need it. They didn't need it. You know, maybe they needed one just to have a little safety net to function. Maybe. But not really. You know, they have about $28 million in cap space right now. But this is money that they can roll over to next year. And next year is critical for Dallas because Dak Prescott, relative to the salary cap, is going to have a massive franchise tag. Massive. Dallas needs to create space for that. If they can't come to an agreement on an extension, they need to create space for it. So Dallas now is up next year, if we were to look at kind of like the worst case scenarios, probably about $28 million in cap room. They're getting close to that number that they need to do Prescott's second tag. And what they've done by doing this now is, again, they've left themselves the option to where if they want to, you know, they can go in there and they can restructure DeMarcus Lawrence again. And let's say they create another $10 million. So now they've gone from you know, only being able to create 10 million to being able to create, you know, they lost three. So let's say that they had 19 million from the same one player. They can go back to Zach Martin next year. So they created their 8 million or so this year with him. They can go back. They can do the same next year, and they can probably create about another 8 million. And, you know, now you're creating a scenario where Dallas is opening themselves a path to get to, say, 50 million in cap room just by restructures for players that you say, okay, you know what? They're probably going to be here for the long haul. Now, in Lawrence's case, I don't know if you'd touch him a second time. The way that they did this right now by doing it this year, his salary for next year was already guaranteed. So the fact that his dead money next year is obscene if they cut him doesn't matter because he was going to be there no matter what. They could still walk away the next year. If they restructure another time, 2022 becomes more of an issue for cutting him. Not impossible, but a little bit more of an issue. I'd be a little bit more worried about him than I would Martin. I don't think Martin will break down. I don't think Smith will break down, you know, if they want to redo those deals again too. But they're opening themselves up a path to do this because I think the players they probably don't want to touch are Amari Cooper, just because I think there's some iffiness there with him, just based on their original contract structure, I would say that. And the other one is Ezekiel Elliott, because that would just kind of be stupid. You know, why you don't double down on a running back. It's bad enough that you single down on a running back. You definitely don't double down on a running back. But these are moves that more teams should be making this year. And I think they're going to. I think teams may want to see how the first, say, 2 weeks of the season shake out as it comes to the coronavirus, because they don't want to lose, you know, they don't want to lose the possibility of recovering money for games lost. You know, if you pay somebody a $10 million signing bonus and you end up only playing three games, well, they still keep that $10 million. If that $10 million was base salary, they would only keep 3/17 of that. So that's one of the reasons why you do that. But when you look forward and you look at the salary cap projections, the Saints 70, well, the Saints, there's nothing the Saints really can do at this point. But you look at the Falcons 37 over, you look at the Steelers projecting around 30 over. This is if they max out their roster numbers. Rams at 18 over, the Raiders at 20 over, the Chiefs at 22 over. Texans at 16 over. These are teams that probably should consider doing some things now with their roster to maximize your carryover so you have easier paths and a lot more flexibility with your decision making to restructure players that you want to restructure. And I think that it would be a smart way to do business. And maybe we'll see that in the coming weeks, because this is kind of your last extension week. So really at this point, you might see one or two the following week, but for the most part, Saturday night, you know, by the time you're probably listening to this, is kind of the end of teams doing extensions, because once the regular season gets underway, they kind of turn away from that. But I don't think they're going to turn away from creating cap space. I think that's something they're going to focus on a little bit more. So we'll have to see where that goes to now as well. Another question that kind of came up this week a little bit is something to do with practice squad elevations and practice squad protections. I'm not as up on the protection stuff. The only thing I will say is I thought Bill Belichick made an interesting comment when people said, well, why didn't you protect anyone? He said, we didn't want to. The reason for that, I think, you're only allowed X amount of protections, I think, a year and certain times back to back and stuff like that. And I think what certain teams are going to do is they're probably going to stash less important positions like kickers that they want to pull up. One of the things that I think you don't want to do is to have a player on your practice squad that you might need during a run towards the playoffs and end up having a team that poaches your practice squad for the sake of competition, not for the sake of really even needing a player. Like, let's say the New England Patriots kept their kicker, for example, on the practice squad, and they would just kind of, you know, bring up and down, up and down, up and down, whatever. One of the things that you may do, you know, as another team, you know, if you're competing with New England for, say, a wild card position, you may go in there and say, well, you know what? We can hurt New England by taking this player off the roster. You know, we can hurt New England by taking this guy. And I think New England might look at that and they'll say, well, you know, our time to protect those players is probably later in the season, you know, when we want to make sure that they're not getting poached. So I think that's kind of where they're getting at with that. But the other one is the practice squad elevation. And I think this is going to be a very interesting one for week one and not as much after that. So a lot of veterans signed to the practice squads this week. You know, the Ogletrees of the world, the kickers in New England, kickers in Chicago, I believe. What teams are going to do is they're going to use this elevation rule. And the elevation rule means you don't sign a player to a new contract. You just elevate him to your active roster. And then you send him back down afterwards. The reason that they're going to do this with these veterans, because you never expect to see these veterans on practice squad contracts. It didn't used to be an option, but you would not normally see a guy who's made $13 million last year say, oh, I'll sign for $204. What they're going to do is they're protecting themselves from termination pay. Termination pay is what happens where we get a full guarantee on the salary in week one. So a lot of veterans sometimes don't make a roster because their salary is fully guaranteed then for the year. If they sign week two, the salary is not guaranteed for the year. It's just used to be 25% of it. Now I think it's 35% of the salary is guaranteed. So, you know, basically 4 or 5 weeks pay. So if you use the practice squad elevation, it's still as if those players weren't on the roster. So it's a real unique situation for teams now because you can take an Ogletree and you can bring him up week one and actually have him on your team starting as a practice squad elevation and not be eligible for termination pay later in the year, even if you re-sign him, you know, to a real contract to be on the regular 53. Same thing on a kicker. Look, if you have a mid-level kicker, you know, the Nick Folks, the Cairo Santos, so all those kind of guys, you don't want to guarantee their salaries because odds are they're 2 or 3 missed kicks away from you kicking them off the team. You don't want to have to actually be potentially responsible for their salary. So I think that's a little bit of an interesting wrinkle that we might see come into play this week. I think that'll be a cool one. And trust me, teams exploit this stuff all the time. We saw like a rash of veterans that were released last week. And the reason for that is you're protecting injured reserve roster spots. So, you know, it's just tricks of the trade that a lot of these teams do in the NFL. So I would expect it. I kind of look forward to it. I think it's an interesting twist. But just be aware that when you see that happen, that's the real reason that it's happening versus signing a player to the regular contract for week one, and bringing them up. So we had our first game this week. A lot of people thought it was crisp football. I didn't think it was crisp. I just thought, you know, Patrick Mahomes is really good. The running back looked pretty good. Texans couldn't tackle anybody. I thought the Texans offense looked completely out of sync. They have a lot of new faces there that they traded for. I think it showed. Watson looked rusty. David Johnson looked decent. Will Fuller looked okay. That was a big game for him. Very important. He's going to be a potential big time free agent this year. I thought the Texans would fall into one of two things. I thought they'd either get the doors blown off them or they would, you know, be very competitive and maybe win. They pretty much got the doors blown off them. They have games like this. This is just the Houston way. I know a lot of people were down on Watson. He signed the biggest big contract. This was the biggest money matchup ever of two quarterbacks, two football players. With the big deals that those two signed, you probably won't see that broken at least for a year or two. It was a bad showing by him, but again, I don't think you're surprised. You know, it's the one of the things that separates, if you do watch a little bit of them, and you know, I'm not going to say I watch every game that these guys play, because obviously I don't. You know, sadly, that's pretty much only the Jets. But what I would say is Watson, very talented, probably holds the ball too long. You saw that on that interception that he threw. But he just has a couple games a year, and so does the whole Texans team, where it's just a lie-down game. You know, you look at them and you say, well, you know, 12 games, they play good to great, and you're not always going to win all those games. You know, maybe you go 9-3 in that stretch, 10-2. And then in the other four games, they just lay an egg. And I think that was what they did here. They just laid an egg. You know, the Chiefs just ran all over him. Mahomes made a couple nice passes. Mahomes would have had a much better night in terms of stats if Robinson could have caught any passes. That guy was dropping things left and right. But, you know, I didn't think it was a great game for either team. So I think it's just a sign that we'll see some somewhat sloppy play in week one. And probably week two, week three. But it was less sloppy on the Chiefs' end than it definitely was on the Texans' end. And, you know, but it was okay. It was good to have football back. It was nice to have those games back. And one of the things that came out from that game, and I missed it, I decided to go and get a little snack instead of watching a portion of the game, I guess, as we got into the third quarter. And there were a bunch of tweets about something that Chris Collinsworth was saying in regards to contracts. And people were saying, I just wish sometimes these guys wouldn't talk about contracts. So I didn't exactly hear it. But from what I gathered, it had to do with the Texans' inability to keep DeAndre Hopkins because of the Deshaun Watson deal. And I think this is where sometimes you can get confused with a lot of stuff. You can always make stuff work with the salary cap. All right, the Texans absolutely could have made things work with DeAndre Hopkins when it comes to the salary cap. There's no reason why they couldn't have, especially when you consider that they brought back a ridiculous number for David Johnson. You know, it's almost as if that would have been a push this year. The issue I think that the Texans had was I think the Texans did not want to get into this discussion of doing probably for them what was going to be the Julio Jones deal. Not that the $27 million that he ended up negotiating for himself, but probably something more similar to the Jones deal, which was going to be a big guarantee, big raise up front, and you know, $23, $24 million new money over two, three more years. And I think they didn't want to go in that area. And one of the things that you have to realize with teams, and people just don't for whatever reason, teams do have budgets. It's not like there's an unlimited supply of money that general managers and cap guys have to work with. Teams do have constraints. And I think the bigger issue for Houston is that Houston knew that they were going to do big deals this offseason. They had to, right? They had to do a big deal for the left tackle, had to do a big deal for the quarterback. And I think they looked at this and they said, well, what's our budget going to be? Now, the Texans historically are one of the cheapest franchises in the NFL, them and the Colts. They're like the teams that fight with that whole 89, 90% level of spending. That's how low they are, typically, you know, where they would be. Their cash number this year is around $252 million. They're over $10 million more than the next closest team, which is the Dallas Cowboys, with a payroll of just under $240 million. So I think the issues that we had here fall into a couple of camps. They fall into a couple of categories. So one is, how much more money would it have cost them to have DeAndre Hopkins if they had to do this deal? And the deal that Hopkins got is going to pay him close to $30 million this year. So you pull out David Johnson's salary from this, which is, you know, 10, 11 million, give or take a little bit. You know, let's add 30 onto that. So basically you'd be looking at a payroll of about $270 million. My guess is that is way too rich for Houston. It's way too rich for any team in the NFL. So that's number one. Number two You open up negotiations with Hopkins, you're setting an awful precedent for basically saying, okay, you know what? We got a pretty good deal the first time around. And even though there's 3 years left on this deal, yeah, we're just going to tear it open. We're going to rip it apart and we're going to do a new one. That's not going to work because you need to worry about other guys on your team. You know, you have to worry about setting precedents for other players for when they're going to expect renegotiations. Do you want to have Deshaun Watson 2 years from now say, hey, wait a minute, Dak Prescott's at 43. I need to renegotiate my deal. It's like, you just signed. So, you know, I think that's kind of another thing that that comes into play with it. So you got a cash consideration. You've got a bad precedent in terms of what you're doing when you're reopening negotiations. That's another one. And then the other thing is, if you want to hold firm on the deal, you know you're going to have a very unhappy player. And why are you going to have a very unhappy player? Well, you're going to have a very unhappy player because you opened up the purse strings for two guys on the team in Watson and Tunsil. You know, at some point, the players say, well, where's mine? You know, you're happy for your teammates, but then where's mine? You know, where's my new deal? So I think you take all those things into account, and that's a reason why they traded him. Now, why they traded him for a bag of chips and David Johnson, that makes no sense. That's a whole different story. But when you just get into the concept of why do you want this player off the team, I think that's probably more where it was coming from, those three things. But from a salary cap standpoint, they absolutely could have done it. You know, they definitely 100% could have done it. Now, again, you want to get into these different things. You know, you could look at it. Probably you could take Brandon Cooks' contract out of it and say, okay, they could have gotten there. So then, well, but you've still got the whole precedent thing. You know, you've still got the potential of the unhappy guy. You've got all these different factors. And I think sometimes you just don't want to deal with it. And, you know, they have a coach who's general manager. A lot of times coaches hate dealing with that stuff. They just don't want to even bother with it. So they just say, get him out. So I think those are the things that come more into play than whatever must have been discussed that had to do with the salary cap and the fact that, well, we paid Deshaun Watson, so that meant you couldn't pay somebody else. I think it's all those other factors that come in there as to what that is. But DeAndre Hopkins did not go simply because they had to pay Deshaun Watson. You know, if DeAndre Hopkins if the Texans knew that he would be happy with his contract, he would still be on the team right now. But I think the fact that they knew he was going to be unhappy with this deal, I think it just opened up too many possibilities for things. So let's take a quick look at the games this week, and then I'll get to your questions here. So I'm just going to do a football pick'em pool on with a couple friends. So these lines are probably from earlier in the week, but we'll just use them anyway for some fun. So let's just run through some of these games. So the Minnesota Vikings are favored by 2.5 against Green Bay. I think Green Bay is a bit of an enigma here. I guess the question is, can Minnesota get some stuff cooking against them? And is Green Bay going to kind of really just lean on their run game a little bit? I think I'd probably take the points here with the Packers. We have the Raiders going to Carolina. Carolina's +2.5. I think the Raiders will run all over them pretty much all game long. I don't really like Carolina here too much at all. Carolina's got a lot of new faces. Might the coaching staff catch some people off guard? They might. You know, and you don't like the travel for the Raiders. I know it's the first game of the season, but you'd probably prefer not having to do that. But I think I'll take the Raiders. I'll lay the 2.5. We've got the Indianapolis Colts at the Jacksonville Jaguars. Jacksonville gets 7.5. I think this could actually be kind of an interesting game. I think Jacksonville does have a couple of weapons on offense to where if they fall behind and the Colts kind of get into preserve mode, I think you could see Minshew and some of their receivers there kind of put up some big numbers. And I think they can pull that within 7.5. The Colts will be decent. I think it's going to take a little time there. Rivers sometimes will play down. So I think I might lean Jacksonville and take the 7.5 there. I don't think Jacksonville will win, but I think they can maybe even just pull like a late cover on the game. We have Detroit as a 3.5 favorite against Chicago. Chicago has no offense. Quinn is also going to be out on defense. That's going to end up being a bad signing. That just looks even worse now. Detroit's got the advantage, obviously, at the quarterback position, though I do think Stafford's a bit overrated. But I think for the opening week, I'd probably lay the 3.5, and I'll go with Detroit. I think they can exploit the secondary. The injury to Golladay would worry me a little bit, but I think they have enough weapons there to kind of take apart the Chicago secondary this week and win by more than a field goal. Baltimore is -8.5 against Cleveland. You know, this is a big game for Cleveland. I think they need to get off to a fast start. They need to get off to a good start. It's a lot of points to lay down. I think if you're the Ravens, there's a lot that's going to be made of, Baltimore from last year. I think in this case, I would take Cleveland. I would take those points and say, you know what, maybe this is just too big of a line. Seattle goes to Atlanta. Atlanta's a 1.5 point dog in that game. It's just a question of how they're going to approach it. You know, based on what you would see last year, I would guess Seattle would run, but I would think they would run absolutely all over the Falcons. Adams should bring another dimension to that defense. That's something that Atlanta maybe is not necessarily prepared for. I think both teams have some continuity that's going to be there, certainly offensively. Can they, can Atlanta get things going with their passing game? Can they get Jones and Ridley both involved somehow to, kind of turn this into a shootout? I don't know. Seattle's a better team. Seattle has more weapons. It's only 1.5. I'd go with Seattle. The Jets travel to Buffalo. Buffalo's a 6.5 point favorite. I think I would, I hate to say this. I'll lay the 6.5. Jets, I just don't see them having any offense. Crowder will probably have a good game. If you're looking for fantasy, just probably a cheap option, DFS. And if anyone's interested, by the way, in DFS, you can email me and I can try and set up like a weekly game or something like that for maybe 10 teams or something. If you're looking for a cheaper option in that, I'm sure he's going to catch a lot of passes against the Bills, play underneath. They'll catch a lot of short passes and everything. But I don't know. I'm just down on the Jets overall. I don't think their offense is any good. I think if Allen runs a little bit, I think he can probably get around a lot of the stuff they do on defense. And they could probably just score enough to, win by 7, 8, 9 points. Philadelphia goes to Washington. Washington is a 6.5 point underdog. I don't like Washington at all. So I would take the Eagles. I'm not as high on the Eagles as a lot of other people, but I think I would lay the 6.5. Miami goes to New England. New England's a 6.5 point favorite. I don't know what to expect from New England at all. I think Miami's going to be very improved this year. I think they're going to be much better. This is one of those weird games. I think Miami would either win this game outright or they're going to get, just have one of those games where Fitzpatrick turns the ball over like 6 times. I don't think there's any in between. I guess I would go New England. Probably. Chargers go to Cincinnati. Cincinnati gets 3.5. Yeah, who knows? Maybe the young kid has a terrific game. More likely he doesn't. I'll take the Chargers there, even with the question marks they have at quarterback. I think their defense should be, even with James down, I think their defense will be more than enough to give a bunch of confusing looks to the Bengals and win that game. Tampa Bay at New Orleans, one of the more interesting games. New Orleans is, they were a 3.5. I think they're up to like a 6.5 point favorite maybe now, maybe 5.5. I think that this is New Orleans game to pretty much win. I think they can make a big statement by really wiping out Tampa Bay. I think Tampa Bay's defense is going to have a hard time with New Orleans offense. It's in the dome. Can Brady, you know, fight with them? I guess he could. I think there's going to be just a little bit of a learning curve for Brady and Tampa. So I think New Orleans will win that game and they'll cover. Arizona goes to San Francisco. San Francisco is a 7.5 point favorite. I'll take Arizona. I think Arizona has a lot of upside this year. They have a lot of downside too, but I think I'll take Arizona to come out there in a surprise kind of game. I would not be shocked if Arizona somehow pulled off an upset in the first week of the season. I wouldn't be surprised by that at all. Dallas travels to LA to take on the Rams. The Rams are 2.5 point favorites. I think the Rams could match up kind of well in this game, and I like Dallas. I think I would take the points in this one. I think Dallas will win, but I think this could be really close. And even though that's the field goal margin there, you know, I think the Rams can possibly win, and I'll take the 2.5 at home. Pittsburgh at the Giants. Giants are 4.5 point underdogs here. I don't like the Giants much this year. I like the Steelers' defense. I like their offensive potential. I'm going to take the Giants, though, only because I feel like the Steelers every year just stink in week one. Now, they might stink and win against the Giants. You know, it's like those years they would stink and they would tie Cleveland or something like that. I just never think the Steelers are ever going to do good in the first week of the season. So I'm going to take the Giants just based on that. And Tennessee goes to Denver. Denver with a big blow. They lose Von Miller. You know, that's really disappointing. You know, you hate to see players go down like that. You know, where that could be the end of a run with a team or something. Even without him, Denver's got a good defense, though. Sutton is going to be, he's hurt. I'm not even sure if he's playing in this game. It sounds like he's got a shoulder, I think, problem. So I'm not sure what the deal is going to be there. So that they may end up trying to run a whole bunch. I don't know how well that'll necessarily work. I'm not big on Tennessee this year. I'll drop the 1.5. I'll take Denver to win that game. And yeah, definitely by 1.5 points. If they're going to win, they're going to win it by more than that. So those are the picks that I'll have for this week. So let's take a look at your questions. So I'll have to pull those up on Twitter. But first, let me just start with my email, because I know last week I had gotten a question, and I got it, I think, during the time I was recording. Or right after. So I know I missed it. Werner, here we go. Looking next season, will we basically see the compensatory picks either disappear for a year or be extremely skewed? For example, the third rounder, only 4 third rounders and 28 seventh rounders awarded. Everyone in the middle class seems to get restructured to a lower level, released or signed only below the new threshold. I do think that you could see some changes next year in regards to the compensatory picks. You know, I've been on the record many times that I think that your star players are COVID proof. So yeah, I think your third and potentially fourth round players are probably still in play. However, yeah, I think the fifth and sixth could absolutely kind of vanish from the equation. You know, and all kind of get bumped down towards that seventh range. That's a great question, though. You know, that's something that I think is going to be real interesting next year. I should mention it to Nick. Maybe he can do something, about that and, you know, a post on it. Let's see. All right. So let me just pop on Twitter here. Okay, CJK asks, I'm missing something here. But okay, so let's start with this. Why all the restructures for Dallas now? They can roll the room over to next year, but they also take on more risk now. Why not do restructures next year before handling Dak and free agency? So, you know, this is what we talked about before. The way that you can maximize the money that you can make is by doing the restructures now. Now, you're doing it from a calculated perspective. Like we said, with DeMarcus Lawrence, he was guaranteed a spot next year anyway. So you've created, at the very least, the net nine. Okay, so you gained 12 this year, and you added 3 to next year's cap number. So you've gained a net $9 million. And yes, you've increased the dead money in 2022, but it's not to the point where it's probably going to impact your decision-making. You could still release him. If you wait until next year, depending on how much you need to create, it might start to impact the decision-making a little more. Or maybe you'd be a little concerned about restructuring him if he has a down year. So I think that's why you do that now with the teams. And, you know, especially just because it's going to give you the chance to make the most money possible for next year and have the most information on hand before you get into restructures next year. Andy asks, Clay Matthews has $2 million in offsets. If he signs midseason for $2 million, is all of it offset or only the prorated per game money actually earned? It's the money actually earned. Would the same thing apply to per game bonuses? Yeah, the same thing would apply to those. So basically, if you contract for, say, $1.7 million, so you get a million a week, and there's only 8 weeks left, $1.7 million would be $100,000 a week, and there's only 8 weeks left, you know, you earn $800,000. That's the offset on it. Now, that's also a good point. So Clay Matthews was in negotiations with Denver this week after Miller got hurt. And a thing came out that he was basically, from the sounds of it, he was offered a minimum contract and they said no. And somebody must have told Schefter from Denver when they asked about this meeting, they must have said he's not going to play this year. And that was obviously taken very negatively by Clay Matthews people. So Clay Matthews took Twitter and said, hey, look, I'm willing to play this year. We just couldn't come to an agreement. And, you know, I think he was pissed about it. So one of the reasons why, and I think Florio brought this up, and I had mentioned this earlier in regards to, it may have been him. Most of these offsets, the way that they work is it offsets for salary earned, but a lot of times teams will put in basically a clause that is money that the player could have earned, you know, essentially meaning if they were offered a reasonable contract, that they could have taken. And if they turn it down, if they're just saying, well, you know what, we don't feel like playing football, that there's a possibility that you could say, well, then you shouldn't get your guarantee from us, you know, because you had an opportunity to earn money from another team. I think where you kind of get these things, and Denver probably shouldn't have said what they said, whomever said it, because it clearly came from the Broncos. I think what probably is their point of view is, look, we offered him a minimum salary deal. He's not going to earn anything more from anyone else. You know, there's nobody, especially at this point in the season, that's going to pay him more money than that. You know, he's got a $2 million guarantee. Nobody's going to go above $2 million. And they just took that to say, you know, he didn't want to play for us for that $105 million. So yeah, he doesn't want to play football this year. That's the bottom line, is he doesn't want to play football. And that's probably the realistic way of looking at it, is that, you know, if he's not going to play for that, he's not going to play football. However, that opens up that can of worms that says, well, you know, that's an opportunity to play. Should he have done that? Does that give the Rams relief of the money they owe him? I don't think it would. And the reason for that is you have to basically be saying you're turning down something legitimate. And so if an offer is made for $1.05 million and your whole career, you know, you've always played for a big salary. And, you know, in his case, just to, let me pull up Clay Matthews here, you know, he was expected to make, I think, six this year. You know, $5.75 million. You know, you would say, well, you know, I was contracted to play for $5.75 million. I'm not playing for less than $5.75 million, or I'm not playing for less than $5 million. Like, that's a fair number. You know, $105 million is not a fair number. Whoops. you know, 1.05 is not a fair number. So I think that's probably where the line of thought is there. And I think that's a reasonable expectation on his part that, you know, he's not going to play for less than what he feels he should be playing for. Andy also asks, can you explain the Ashawn Robinson contract restructure? How can his P5 be lower than the vet minimum? How are practice squad players that are activated on game day compensated, and do they affect the cap? So Ashawn Robinson, there was an article, I think it was by Albert Breer on SI, that was pretty interesting. Basically, he wanted to opt out of the season. The Rams didn't want him to. So they came to an agreement that they would place him on a non-football injury list, and they would pay him $500,000 while he's on that list. You know, basically be similar to opting out, you know, a little bit better than that. You know, and they would do some other things with the contract as well. Now, the reason is paragraph five can be lower than the veteran minimum is because when a player goes on a non-football injury or illness list, they're not, team is not required to pay them. The contracted salary is the typical base salary on the deal. So in this case, I think Breer reported that it's $1 million. So, you know, his main number was probably 910,000. You don't negotiate even the split aspect of the NFI. You know, a team can opt for zero. A team can opt to pay a player at a practice squad salary rate. They can keep it at the same rate. So you can go below the minimums for veteran players because they're on an NFI list. Now, if they're on an injured reserve list, you got to put a split in there, and you can only go down to the split, which is also probably 500,000 for, I'm not as up on the split numbers this year, but it's probably right around 500,000 also for someone his level. So that may even be where the 500 comes from. It may come from a split that's in that contract. One of my friends made a good point to me that wondered, you know, isn't that kind of skirting the rules a little bit? And it really is. You know, I don't know if the Rams are going to get away with this one or not. You know, what is exactly his illness or injury that's allowing him to be on this list? You know, which lets him be reactivated later on. So that's an interesting little scenario. For your second question, how are the practice squad players that are activated on game day compensated, and does it affect the cap? Yes, it affects the cap, and they're compensated at the minimum salary. So, you know, if you're a veteran player that's on the 204 practice squad contract, your salary will bump up to the 1.05 million or the 910, depending on what your experience level is. So let's say it's 910. You know, you divide that by 17, so your game check will be 53,529.41. For the week. If you're not, you know, bumped up, and you know, and this if you're a veteran, you'd be paid 204, so that's the $12,000 payment for the week. And those all impact the salary cap. So let's take a look here. What are the questions? It says I have four, but I only see three. Twitter changed this this view stuff now. I'm not crazy on this. Let's see. All right, I don't know. Hopefully I didn't miss one here. All right, let's take a look at next set of questions here. All right, Butchie O'Dwyer asks, when a guy like Pete Guerrero gets signed and cut by the Jets a bunch of times during camp, does he get any compensation for it? Does he get a signing bonus, money for each practice? Yeah, no, he doesn't get a signing bonus each time. They do have like small amounts of money that they get paid in the preseason and stuff like that during camp. Not in like these donut periods kind of in between, but there are some payments that you get for the off season stuff that doesn't count towards the cap. This doesn't count towards the cap. You know, I'm not as usually familiar with that. I mean, I can look it up to see, but they do get paid a little bit of something for when they're there, but not for his latest one, which was, I think he got signed for like a day. It seemed like, I don't think there was anything for that. Julian asks, do you see the Chargers re-signing Desmond King with Hayward and Harris on IR? I'm sorry, with Hayward and Harris on bigger deals, not on IR. I don't know. You know, I'm not really sure what the Chargers are going to be doing. I've thought that they've approached things weird with just a couple of different things, and I'm not sure where they're going to go with anything there. I think go in a lot of different directions. What team is in the worst shape with the cap next year? Is it the Falcons? No, it's the New Orleans Saints. Falcons are in bad shape too. But the New Orleans Saints are above and beyond any other team in the NFL. Francis, what's your favorite Star Wars character? That's a good one. When I was little, Luke Skywalker was always my favorite Star Wars character. I don't know. I like so many of the characters from that. Obviously, the Han Solo is a very popular character. Darth Vader. Nothing from the prequels. I'm not hated those prequels pretty much. I can't understand why my daughter and her friends, they love the prequels. So the kids all love the prequels now. I was not a big fan of them. definitely when those came out. But all those characters really from that, the original trilogy, always stood out for me as just everyone I just really enjoyed from that. I think a lot of people know I'm a big Star Wars fan. So, I could talk all day if I wanted to, probably on Star Wars and everything else. But it's those characters really stand out, I think, from that original group. You know, it was the perfect set, I think, of people to kind of portray them. And I think that there was just, enough of the backstories and stuff that they had there that turned it into a universe and kind of made it interesting. And I think that was the stuff that was missing kind of from the other ones. I definitely thought it was missing from the prequel set almost completely. With the lone exceptions, where McGregor is Ben Kenobi and Liam Neeson, I think in the first one is Qui-Gon Jinn. I didn't like that movie, but I liked his portrayal in that. And when it came to the sequels, there were different ones, different aspects of it that I liked. I liked The Force Awakens. I know a lot of people didn't because they thought it was like a rehash movie. But I kind of liked it, I think, because it was a rehash, kind of brings you back to being, 3 years old again or something. With the seeing those characters again and, some of them coming back and everything. And, of the sequels, the only one that I didn't like, and I know that's not the original question here, but it was really this last one that, I really wasn't crazy about. I think the Last Jedi grew on me, even though it seemed kind of like Bizarro World Star Wars, with the way that they went with Luke Skywalker in that one. Love those sets of movies. But I could probably have a different favorite character just about every day. But they would almost, they'd all exclusively come from those first three movies is where the favorite characters would come from. DB4, how likely is a Juju extension with the wide receiver money being thrown around, a cap reduction, TJ Watt, huge money? I don't see Juju getting a big deal at all from Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh walks away from receivers all the time. I think the fact that he was out without, that just didn't play that well without Ben Roethlisberger in there, I think that tells you a lot. So I would be surprised if it got done unless he was going to really sign for a lot less money, but I don't see that one. They have a lot of cap issues as well. I just don't see that. Doug asks, how expensive would a Matt Milano contract extension be for Buffalo? Let's take a look at this here. Yeah, you have to wait to see how this year shakes out. I'm not sure what they would actually, let's take a look. Let's just pull up his numbers here. Just quickly looking at this, so you're looking basically at 85% play time. He also does specials as well. Yeah, 65 tackles last year. Covers okay. Now, I think you'd probably be looking at somewhere in the ballpark of $11 million a year. Those numbers can go down, they can go up. You know, depending on how this year shakes out, I would guess he'd probably be in that range of those players like the Blake Martinez's of the world that were like at that 10.75, 11.5, you know, maybe right around 12. I would guess that's probably where he would be. You know, that would be my guess. And let's see if I have anything else here. And it looks like that is it. So that should do it for me. So everybody enjoy the games this week. And we'll be back next week, probably late Friday night. So you can hear something on Saturday. And again, if you have any questions, just fire them over. Any comments, any beer suggestions for getting through the Jets game, let me know. So you guys all have a great week. Enjoy the games on Sunday. And I will talk to you all again soon.